Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So glad to be keeping you company today, and I'm hoping you'll join in our conversation this hour as well. Well, it's already been a pretty ugly race, at least among Democrats, and it's tempting to look for the silver lining. Among some political watchers, the buzz this season is the word postpartisan, the idea that there might be a movement away from voting along doggedly partisan lines. Well, it's a pretty idea, a tempting idea to believe in, but this hour we'll learn about new research that puts the idea of a postpartisan election in 2008 back on the shelf, at least for now. We'll be talking with William Galston, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a former policy advisor to President Clinton and other presidential candidates. Mr. Galston is an expert on domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections. His current research focuses on designing a new social contract and the implications of political polarization. His article, Vote Like Thy Neighbor, written with Mr. Pietro Nivola, appears in the May 11th issue of the New York Times Magazine. There's an open door for you to join your neighbors today and tell us what you think. Do you see evidence of a postpartisan era around you? Do you look at your neighborhood and county and see people just like you, who vote like you, or is there a mix of people? And are we ready for a postpartisan election? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And William Galston, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the idea of a postpartisan era. What exactly do people mean when they use that term?
Well, I think they mean something very simple, namely that the bitter partisan divisions that have characterized recent American politics have become so distasteful to so many Americans that they are prepared to opt for an entirely different kind of politics where the divisions are less important than what unites us.
What evidence do you see that that could be coming about? Obviously, the research in your article shows otherwise, but this idea has to be coming from somewhere.
I think a lot of it is traceable to the Obama campaign. From the very beginning of his rise to national prominence, his famous 2004 Democratic Convention speech, Senator Obama has articulated the idea of a new and different kind of politics. One that emphasized what the red and blue states have in common rather than what divides them, what Democrats and Republicans have in common, what liberals and conservatives have in common, what religious and secular Americans have in common. And it's clearly an idea with a great deal of resonance, at least on the plane of theory. Regrettably, our research suggests that when we actually get down to the general election, it is going to prove very, very difficult to abolish or even to diminish significantly the sorts of divisions that have characterized and many believe disfigured our politics for so long.
When was the research done?
The research was conducted by a bipartisan team. The Brookings Institution here in Washington and the Hoover Institution on Stanford University, so it was bicoastal as well. And a lot of it was done by scholars associated with those two institutions, but some of it was done by distinguished scholars, political scientists, and others from around the country as well. And it's all been done over the past 2 or 2.5 years, and the results have been published in two volumes called Red and Blue Nation? One of the volumes is focused on the dimensions and causes of political polarization, and the other is focused on the consequences and possible cures. And I should say that we didn't begin our project with the idea that we were going to find polarization or find that there is a lot more polarization than there used to be. In fact, many of the participants in the project argued very strenuously to the contrary, and we conducted a number of very interesting and sometimes heated scholarly debates. And at the end of it all, Pietro Nivola, who was one of the two co-editors, along with David Brady from Hoover, and I really came to the conclusion that polarization is real, that it is more intense and extensive than it was a few decades ago, and that it has taken deep root in American society and certainly in the American party system.
Well, I want to get down to the nuts and bolts of what exactly the studies found, but I have to ask the question, too. You said that the rise of Obama's campaign, and he's been sort of billing himself as a big uniter, mm-hmm. is what has given sort of rise to the idea of living in a postpartisan era. And how is it, you know, how direct are these results of the study if sort of the big movement, the Obama movement, happened after the study was done?
Well, a lot of it... first of all, a lot of the work was done certainly all of it was done after the enormous resonance of Senator Obama's 2004 campaign speech, convention speech,
the first time he appeared on the scene, really.
Right, and a lot of it was done after Senator Obama. Announced his candidacy for president and began to get a pretty enthusiastic response right from the start, and from nowhere vaulted into second place in the Democratic contest, a mm-hmm. position he never surrendered and which he ultimately built into first place. So it's not as though we were unaware of the Obama phenomenon, nor is it the case that the Obama phenomenon refutes our findings. Senator Obama ended up commanding the support of slightly more than half of Democratic primary voters. And those Democratic primary voters were hardly postpartisan. They tended to be more liberal, more secular, younger. The idea that young adults are postpartisan is a mistake. In fact, young adults today are much more likely to identify as Democrats, much more likely to describe themselves as liberals, much more likely to be liberal on the role of government in the economy, on social policy, and on foreign policy. So that's not exactly a formula for postpartisanship, unless one simply expects the other side to give in, which I think is not in the cards.
Well, let's talk about the nuts and bolts of what you actually found. As you said, one of the things is that younger Americans tend to be more liberal. What else did you find, especially in terms of the polarizing effect that you're talking about here?
Well, first of all, we looked at history and very, very broadly. We described the way in which the post-World War II period of political consensus collapsed in the period between 1965 and 1980. The Dwight Eisenhower had brought the Republican Party into basic alignment with the New Deal. Eisenhower and his supporters called it modern republicanism, and what it meant was that they accepted the basic premises of the New Deal, but said that government could be run more efficiently, more parsimoniously. And that agreement on economic fundamentals began to collapse in the 1970s under the impact of stagflation, and then an alternative to Keynesian economics, namely supply-side economics, became prominent in the mid and late 1970s and became national policy when an important presidential candidate, Ronald Reagan, embraced it. Foreign policy, of course, the post-World War II anti-communist consensus was shattered on the rocks of the Vietnam War and sank, and those divisions have persisted ever since. And then, of course, the counterculture and various social movements and various Supreme Court decisions in the 1960s and the 1970s undid the cultural consensus that had prevailed and launched the culture wars, which have been with us more or less ever since. So there was all of that in the background, and Then you had something else going on, namely that voters started to sort themselves out. When I was a boy and a young man, there were lots of conservative Democrats and lots of liberal Republicans. No more. Now you have a liberal party and a conservative party. And the amount, the number of people in the middle, it turns out, is smaller than it used to be.
So you have all these people clustered on opposite ends of the poll now, right?
Well, it's more, that's more the case than it used to be. There's an outfit called the American National Election Studies that has been monitoring these things for decades, and as recently as 1984, about 41% of the electorate was clustered at or near the ideological middle of the spectrum. 20 years later, in the John Kerry George W. Bush contest in 2004, that had declined to 28%, and the people who had left the middle had migrated toward the left and right poles. There are still somewhat more people in the middle, but the curve is a lot flatter, and the left and right tails are a lot higher than they used to be. Then along with this political sorting out, we found something even more startling, namely a geographical sorting out.
Right. That's really interesting. It sounds as though people are even choosing to live next to people who are just like them and who vote like them.
Well, you know, it really appears that way. It's hard to think of any other explanation. And let me tell you what drove us to that. Some very interesting research has been done on voting patterns in counties across the country. Now, the reason that's important is that county lines, unlike congressional districts, aren't gerrymandered. Once they're established, they tend to stay fixed for decades. And so you can study the changing voting patterns within these fixed geographical regions. And it turns out that an increasing number of counties are giving supermajorities to one party or the other. That is, you have an increasing percentage of counties where one candidate of one party is getting 60% of the vote or more. We call them landslide counties, and that percentage has just about doubled in recent decades. More and more Americans are living in areas where there is clearly a dominant party, a dominant ideology, and a party and an ideology in the minority. And interestingly, the same thing is even happening on the state level. One of the things that we did to dramatize this was to compare four very close elections: the Kennedy-Nixon election of 1960, the Ford-Carter election of 1976, the Bush-Gore election of 2000, and the Bush-Kerry election of 2004. And what we found in the case of 1960 and 1976, elections decided by very close margins, is that a very large number of states were decided by 5 percentage points or less of the popular vote. Well, if you look at the elections of 2000 and 2004, which were decided by similarly narrow margins, the number of states decided by that kind of narrow margin had been cut roughly in half, so that you had a phenomenon that commentators started talking about, that is, fewer and fewer competitive states. More and more states were in one camp or the other from the very beginning of the race, and all of the focus was on 12 or 15 or 20 at most. Well, that's not the way it was as recently as 1976, and certainly not in 1960. So even at the state level, there's more homogeneity than there used to be. There are more supermajority states and fewer closely contested states. A lot of people hope that's going to change in 2008. I really hope it does, because democracy is stronger when there's competition the length and breadth of the country, but in recent years, that certainly hasn't been the case.
Yeah, you have to think that it can't be very good for American politics, for democracy, when there are entire states that are just sort of going de facto to one political party or the other. And obviously, you're studying the implications of this, but if it keeps trending this way, what do you think the implications are going to be? They can't be good.
Well, look, I don't want to pretend that history moves in a straight line, and certainly not American history. You can look at the broad sweep of American history and see currents and then countercurrents. And so I certainly don't want to go on record as predicting that this is our fate forever and ever. It's certainly possible that there will be historical and demographic forces that will shift things back. But I do think it, among other things, that it tends to depress political participation when only a certain number of congressional districts and a certain number of states are truly competitive, because candidates tend to spend less time in areas that they take for granted, or conversely, in areas that they assume they're going to lose, and lose by a wide margin no matter how much time and energy and money they invest. And in those circumstances, the minority tends to get very depressed. And is not very interested in the race, stays home, and the majority gets very complacent. Political competition, this is one of the basic principles of democracy, and certainly of our democracy, political competition is good. It is the enemy of complacency, in the same way that economic competition is the enemy of complacency. You get into all sorts of bad habits if you're not challenged.
And as you say in the article, polarization feeds on itself. We'll hear more about that idea when we come back. I'm just going to jump in now to take a quick break as we talk with William Galston, who is co-author with Pietro Nivola of the article Vote Like Thy Neighbor, which runs this Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. Galston is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former policy advisor to President Clinton. I hope you'll join in our conversation this hour and tell us what you think. Do you see evidence or have hope for a postpartisan era, maybe even in 2008? Or do you look around at your neighborhood and your state and see people who are voting just like you, who think just like you? And if so, does that worry you? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert in today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As Wisconsin greens up, how is your lawn coming along? After 11 o'clock, Jim Packer talks with the UW-Madison turf grass expert about starting and maintaining a healthy lawn. That's coming up on Garden Talk after 11 o'clock today. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you today. I'm sitting in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we're talking about the prospects for a postpartisan era. Our guest William Galston says the prospects aren't so good. According to his article, Vote Like Thy Neighbor, which runs this Sunday in the New York Times Magazine, the evidence of polarization is actually growing instead of diminishing. And we're hoping to take your calls this hour. Tell us what you think at 1-800-642-1234. And William Galston, we have some folks on the line waiting to talk. Let's take a call from Stephen in Madison. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
I find the analysis somewhat simplistic. The idea that there's any real partisan competition here is rather more of a brainwashing illusion that we've suffered with since the period after World War II. If there was true partisan differences, there'd be a capitalism fascism party and an anti-fascism party in this country. Instead, we have both fake Dems and the Republicans striving to build up the Pentagon, the global dominance project with ever new weapon systems. We had the convergence on the fake, the hoax of 9/11, putting the blame on the supposed Arab hijackers when, in fact, those buildings were pulverized with explosives.
Well, Stephen, just getting back to the postpartisan idea, though, are you saying there's not that much difference between the two parties?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And instead of, say, as in European democracies, there are many parties. Here we get a choice between strawberry and vanilla. And I just think the empire has achieved consensus, first with a so-called fear of communism and now with this fake war of terrorism. Thank you so very much.
All right. Thanks for calling, Stephen. What do you think about that argument? There are people who think just like Stephen there that the parties aren't that different. And when we're talking about polarization, we're talking about a tiny spectrum that is polarized.
Well, setting aside the comments about 9/11,
right,
you know, which are an excellent example of paranoid conspiracy theories, it is certainly the case that if you look at American politics in the context of European politics, the range of political debate in the United States since World War II is not nearly as wide as it has been in Europe during that period. Right after World War II, there were certainly powerful communist parties throughout Western Europe, as well as socialist parties. And there were parties on the far right. They didn't call themselves fascists for a while because fascism had taken something of a beating during World War II, let us recall. But they were still there, and you know, some of them have made a kind of quasi-respectable reappearance in places like Italy and elsewhere. Nonetheless, the differences that do exist between the political parties are regarded by the majority of Americans as significant, and it seems to me that that's what counts politically. And to the extent that there are important issues not being articulated by either political party, American political history suggests that third and fourth party movements come along. And if enough people agree with the proposition that new ideas and new options ought to enter the political system, then typically one of the major parties or the other, and sometimes even both, will take over those new ideas. So that's how the political spectrum in this country is widened, or one of the ways. Another way is through social movements. And these movements have changed the face of American politics in my adult lifetime in every conceivable way, whether it has to do with the conduct of foreign policy, with race relations in the United States, with relations between men and women, our attitude towards the environment. All of these movements from outside the official political system have deeply influenced that system.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Bruce in Milwaukee. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi there. Mr. Galston, I think you are right onto the topic. If you look at things on a county basis here in Wisconsin in two recent elections, the state Supreme Court election, if you compare Milwaukee County with Waukesha County, you see that same proportion where 60% in Milwaukee went for Butler, the liberal candidate, and in Waukesha it was the exact opposite, where it went for the GOP candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you track that particular election through all the counties, you saw a very similar situation where certain counties were rigidly locked into a certain partisanship attitude that's reflected in the voting. And in Milwaukee County, you had a black woman running against a young white man, a conservative versus a liberal, and the conservative candidate Walker came out with the weekend before the election, he came out with postcards and media coverage and ads that said no new taxes, and claimed that his opponent was pro-abortion, had a pro-abortion agenda, and that he was the son of a pastor and understood community values. Sadly, the liberal candidate does not share our values, was proclaimed loudly on this literature. Talk about partisanship to an extreme in a county executive election. I'm afraid this is going to be reflected in the national election in 08 around race and partisanship. And, you know, I just don't think this concept that there is a bridge is a real one. I think we are far more partisan than we've ever been.
Hmm. Well, thank you for that call, Bruce. And I assume you agree with Bruce, William Galston.
Well, that, regrettably, I mean, I'm not saying this with any pleasure, because to be frank and personal, I would prefer a much less polarized and much less partisan politics.
That's what's so interesting.
And
I think everyone would.
The reason for that, and this is something that Pietro Nivola and I talk about in the two articles that we co-authored for this study, there are lots of things that are hard to do if if a country is bitterly divided along partisan lines. There are some issues that are so challenging that they can only be tackled when people get together. And, you know, I could spend a lot of time talking about that. I'd rather leave the time for your listeners. But a polarized partisanship has some, politics has some real costs attached to it. So I'm not cheerleading for this phenomenon. I'm just describing it. And, you know, the caller has put on the table exactly the kind of evidence that we looked at across the country. And I wish I could say that, you know, that the polarized county phenomenon that he described in Wisconsin were unique or an outlier, but it's not. It's much more the rule than the exception, and that's the kind of evidence that drove us to our conclusion.
You know, it's interesting. After reading your article, I sort of saw the neighborhood I lived in differently, and I thought back, and it seems as though everyone does have sort of the same signs on their lawns. You don't really see much mixing it up in terms of that. And you have to wonder. I mean, on the one hand, it's sort of the whole point of a sign maybe is to, you know, reassure the feeling that you're not alone in something and to draw people into that sort of same mindset, which can be kind of reassuring if you're voting a particular way. But on the other hand, you know, it's also sort of discouraging because nobody really, I would think, would profess to loving partisan politics. It's not a synonym for anything good. And if people, you know, on the whole are sick of partisan politics, then why are we seeing them on the rise?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And part of it, political scientists have dug into that question. And Here's what they typically find. You know, people in local neighborhoods will often say things like the following: we are sick and tired of all of the bickering and quarreling in Washington. Why don't our representatives just, you know, roll up their sleeves, get down to business, and agree on common sense solutions to our nation's problems? That's a very typical grassroots sentiment. But when you actually probe a little deeper at the neighborhood level, you'll find that this idea of solving problems pretty easily once you sit down at the table makes sense, because when people sit down at the local table, they tend to be surrounded by people like themselves. And so the idea of post-partisanship makes a lot of sense intuitively in a local environment in which the range of opinion is not as nearly as great as it is in the Congress of the United States or in the country as a whole. And if you ask, well, why is this happening? It turns out that there's a lot of truth to the ancient adage that birds of a feather flock together. People say they like diversity. And that's true up to a certain point, but to put it bluntly, for most people, diversity is a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. You're happy to sample a diverse regional environment, but when it actually gets down to where you choose to live, you don't necessarily want to live cheek by jowl. With people whose lifestyle is very different from yours and whose opinions are very different from yours, especially if they're not shy about expressing those opinions. Most Americans, it turns out, are conflict avoiders, not just in their private lives, but also in their public lives. They don't seek out argument. They don't seek out conflict. Ideally, their surrounding environment is less challenging and more harmonious.
Well, back to the phones now, and we'll take a call from Bill in Winneconne. Hello, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for such an interesting program. I have a kind of a methodological but not abstruse question to ask you. I've often thought that the debate in America, the polarization thing, was really manufactured by the press to a large degree that talks to people in the extremes, which you obviously have done, covered the middle pretty well, too, and that this plays like a good horse race. But what I'm concerned about is when you do your survey of attitudes, can you actually measure them against behavior? In other words, you have vast numbers of people in the country that are in the middle, and many of them, I would assume, don't vote. But if you could somehow correlate their voting, actual who they would vote for and why, as a, and look at their ideology or what they profess to believe, I think you'd find an awful lot more people in their voting behavior falling in the middle. This notion of a dumbbell-shaped, I mean, you referred to it earlier, but the notion of a dumbbell-shaped curve with vast numbers of peoples at either extreme, I think is highly misleading, especially the evidence you just said that people that actually sit down and talk together, in other words, behaviorally, they have to work things out, behave very differently than they might actually tell an interviewer on values or something like that. Do you have any comments? Or I may be very wrong, because I don't know your study.
Well, it's a reasonable question, and one of the great things about the data sets that we used is that they permit us to evaluate the relationship between people's self-professed ideology on the one hand and how they vote and how they act in politics on the other, because the surveys don't just talk about their attitudes. They also talk about, ask about their voting behavior. And it turns out, and this is one of the basic findings of our study, that today your party affiliation and your ideological self-identification are much more closely associated with your voting patterns than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And so we're not talking about anecdotes. You know, we're talking about a very large, statistically valid sample of the population as a whole. That's what the American National Election Studies is. And now you could be making a related point, which a lot of scholars have emphasized, and I think rightly, namely that the choices that people make are a function of the choices available to them, and that people may act in a more polarized way than they'd like to if it's the case that the choices before them are more polarized. And so there may be some truth to the idea that if the political parties put up more moderate candidates, depolarizing candidates, that people would vote for them, many people in the middle would vote for them with a great sense of relief. Having said that, it is also the case that it is hard to argue away the historical patterns that these studies have uncovered as recently as the 1980s. Just to repeat, when you did a very fine-grained survey of how people describe themselves based on how they respond to a large set of particular issues that have ideological dimensions, as recently as the mid-1980s, you had about 41% of the population saying that they were at or near the sort of the moderate midpoint of the ideological spectrum. Today, that number is a lot lower, and the number espousing either extreme liberal or extreme conservative positions and identifying themselves as such has expanded. Now, I don't mean to say that there are more people at the extremes than there are at the middle. I never said that, certainly didn't intend to say that. What I am saying is that the ratio of people in the middle to people at the extremes has changed pretty dramatically in the past quarter century, and that's bound to have an effect on our politics.
We're talking this hour with William Galston, who is co-author of the article Vote Like Thy Neighbor, which runs this Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. Galston is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former policy advisor to President Clinton. Well, we have a couple of open phone lines now, so why not call and tell us what you think? Do you think we are ready to move into a postpartisan era, or do you see evidence, as the research seems to suggest, that we're sort of more deeply entrenched in partisan politics than ever? And do you think this election will change things, maybe if Obama gets the Democratic nomination and you believe what he says about uniting, maybe McCain will also offer a uniting platform as well? Be interesting times coming up. Tell us what you think at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 2 o'clock today, stay tuned for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today, the latest AIDS news. It's been 25 years since the discovery of the AIDS virus. Join us for a discussion of how far we've come in fighting the disease, including setbacks in the search for a vaccine and a new call for prevention. That's at 2 o'clock today on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Veronica Rickard back with you today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking with William Gulston, who is co-author of the article Vote Like Thy Neighbor, which highlights evidence that shows American politics is becoming more entrenched in the partisan instead of less, despite of what some of the buzz has been this election season, that maybe we are ready to move in a post-partisan direction. And William Gulston, I want to ask you if you can extrapolate a little from your research and look ahead to 2008 in terms of what you think we might find in terms of partisanship, depending on who's running. If Obama does get the nomination, he has billed himself as the big uniter. But no matter who gets that Democratic spot, are we going to see that as a theme once we get sort of past the bickering, at least on the Democratic side?
Well, as Yogi Berra once said, prediction is difficult, especially about the future. He denies he said it, but it sounds consistent with other things he's alleged to have said. Let me tell you what I'm afraid is going to happen, and this may be despite the best intentions of the two candidates. John McCain is going to try to separate himself from President Bush. He has to, because President Bush is as unpopular as any president in recent memory. And so McCain is going to try to emphasize his maverick credentials and to some extent his moderate credentials. You know, he's going to talk about things like climate change and torture and a number of different areas where he has broken with the orthodoxy of his party. And I suspect that if Senator Obama is the nominee, and it's looking more and more as though he will be, that one of the strategic imperatives of his campaign will be to argue, in effect, this guy McCain claims to be a moderate and a maverick, but you know what? He's really much more conservative than you think he is. You know, take a look at his position on Iraq. Take a look at his position on home mortgages. Take a look at his position on abortion and social questions. And similarly, Senator Obama is going to argue that that he is a potential uniter. Because he can bring people together across partisan and ideological and racial and ethnic lines. That's been the heart and soul of his campaign message. And I suspect that the McCain campaign is going to have as one of its major strategic imperatives convincing the American people that this guy Obama claims to be a uniter, but he's actually much more liberal than you think he is. And if the campaign plays out that way, then one side will be arguing that the opposing candidate is a conservative and that's a bad thing, and the other side will be arguing that the opposing candidate is a liberal and that's a bad thing,
right.
And that if you want something in the middle, you're better off with me than the other guy, because you can't win a campaign on the basis of just the conservative vote or just the liberal vote. You have to get a big chunk of what's in between, and there are more conservatives than there are liberals, so that the candidate representing the more liberal position needs to get an even larger share of the moderate vote in order to get a majority. So if the campaign plays out the way I think it will, then the question of partisanship and ideology is bound to come front and center, even if the campaign doesn't start out that way.
kind of hard to imagine it moving in any other direction, because it's so much easier to knock the other guy off the horse by talking about how they're different and extreme than by talking about how they're kind of like you, but here's a few key differences. It just seems like the easiest way to unseat your opponent.
Mm-hmm. Now, Seth, look, I will say that, you know, that both Senator Obama and Senator McCain do have a history of trying at least to acknowledge the other side's argument, you know, rather than simply dismissing it as beyond the pale. Neither of them is a knee-jerk partisan. But I'm afraid that the logic of the situation is going to compel each one to try to push the other out of the mainstream and onto one of and onto one of the extremes or the other, and that's the kind of campaign that I think is going to raise the sorts of ideological issues that our study has examined.
Going back to the phones, here is Dave calling from Appleton. Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for the program. I'm curious as to why you've not mentioned the most obvious and what has been the issue for the last 7 years of election cycles, no matter what the office. But it really has been, and it's obvious, that the religious sect has been, it's been conquer and divide this nation with the issues of, well, obvious, you know, guns and gays, and this country was duped into electing a president with these religious issues that is now being run by the energy industry and the medical community. It's rather obvious, and why that hasn't come up in the conversation is curious to me.
Well, let's talk about that now, Dave. And William Galston, you do talk about how, in terms of how the country is dividing itself, it's sort of going along lines of youth and education, and those people tend to be more liberal, people with college degrees, and people who are more focused on family and religious values, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. And, you know, and our study devotes a lot of time to precisely the sorts of questions that the caller raised. And I personally have spent a lot of time studying the impact of religion on political polarization. And while I wouldn't equate religion with the energy industry or the medical industry or even the National Rifle Association, it is certainly the case that religious observance, not so much denomination, but religious observance has emerged as one of the great polarizing factors in American politics. Roughly speaking, the more often you go to church or, you know, another form of religious organization, the more likely you are to identify yourself as a conservative and to vote Republican. And the less frequently you go, or if you don't associate with any religion at all, the more likely you are to think of yourself as a liberal and to vote Democratic. And I can tell you, as recently as 30 years ago, that wasn't the case, but it is certainly the case now. And so it is now something that needs to be taken into account. It is an ingredient of the kind of cultural politics that we've gotten used to in the past couple of generations that you know, wasn't really present when I was a boy.
Well, let's take a call now from Jim in Salt Lake City. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Hey, I wonder about the factor of incumbency. That seems more important than partisanship on the local basis, not talking about presidential. I guess the example I like to give is I went to a political convention 2 years ago as an observer, the Republican convention, and everyone was upset with Orrin Hatch because they controlled both houses in the presidency. Taxes weren't cut. Government didn't get smaller. All this list of items were never even tried. And so when Senator Bennett spoke for his nomination, his only remarks were, "We'll consider the alternative. You know, you're going to nominate one of these guys? Or are you going to, you know, try your hand with the Democrats, or are you going to try with someone you know?" And And he was just relieved that he got the 60%, so he didn't have to have a primary. But it seems like incumbency is more important, especially in partisan politics, except for maybe what happened with Senator Lieberman and also in Rhode Island. It just seems like your ticket's punched once you're in, unless you are caught on tape or being indicted for a felony. You're there till you're in the grave.
So what do you think, William Galston? Does incumbency sort of trump partisanship?
Doesn't always trump partisanship, but I think every political scientist would agree that it's very important. That's why we draw such a sharp distinction between so-called open seats, where there is no incumbent, and seats where a challenger is running against an incumbent. And it's much more likely that a seat is going to switch from one party to the other, or a Senate position will shift if the competition is in the context of an open race rather than trying to knock off an incumbent. I mean, an incumbent starts off with advantages. The incumbent is almost always better known. The incumbent almost always has a wealth of relationships, including a fundraising network. The incumbent almost always has a group of people who have benefited in very, very concrete ways from his or her incumbency. Those are hard things to overcome, so there's no question about it. However, it doesn't follow that incumbency always trumps partisanship. And it's also the case that the threat of a primary tends to keep incumbents in line. Incumbents hate primary challenges. That's one of the first laws of politics. And they're more likely to generate primary challenges from within their own party if they deviate from the party line on some important issues and important votes. And so the threat of a primary challenge tends to contribute to polarization because the challenge is always from the more extreme wing of the party that's disgruntled by your moderation or deviation. And the example of Senator Lieberman that the caller mentioned is just perfect, a perfect example of that.
Well, we thank you for your call, Jim. And we'll go on now to Michael in Danbury. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the discussion. Comment is simply this: is that I think the bell curve, where there's this huge middle, is in fact very healthy and very much in place. However, the perception of the Dem bell curve seems to me is that both the Republican Party as well as the Democratic Party have captured each about 23% of the registered voters in each camp, and neither party is willing to take the risk to expand that to any level. And as a consequence, we get this pushing back and forth. And what they seem to be pushing back and forth is this three-legged stool. One is getting control of this economic machine, which we call the United States. The other piece is having the war machine, which we can mount very well globally now. And then the third piece is the social legislation. And until we recognize that they turn our political process into a power struggle between who has the resources and which way they're going to push it, and until they expand the party sizes, we're not going to break the back of this. And the one last comment is that I don't think Obama positions himself as a uniter at all. I think his position is that, look, American public, if we're going to make a difference here, we have to work together for a common cause, and it's not up so much to the president and him necessarily or whoever. It is up to you and I, and I think we saw that beginning in the 2006 election, is the people are finally building momentum and getting ready to push both Democrats and Republicans out because they're absolutely tired of the self-serving form of government that we've evolved into.
I'm going to have to jump in here and let our guest answer. And William Galston, we've got about 20 seconds for you here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the caller said that Senator Obama wasn't trying to run as a uniter, and then he described someone who did seem to be trying to run as a uniter. So I scratched my head a little bit. But we have been dealing with a pretty limited political universe. I agree with the caller about that. The good news is that you have millions of new voters flooding into the system, in 2007 and 2008, and I do hope that breaks the logjam one way or the other.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate your time this hour. It's been fascinating. Not exactly hopeful so far, but interesting stuff to talk about it. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
William Galston is the co-author of the article Vote Like Thy Neighbor, which runs this Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.